Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Questions from the Audio Road. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford, and I'll be taking your calls and answering your questions for the next hour or so. Lisa is here with us, screening calls and keeping things light and fun. If you want to join in, simply press 1 on your phone, and Lisa will be right with you. This is the show that puts the money where it belongs, back in your pocket. Sit back, relax, and listen, or jump in and ask your question. You can even bring us your opinion. It's up to you. This is your show. You can ask questions about fuel mileage, tires, engine, EGR, aerodynamics, truck specking, maintenance, taxes, financial planning, getting started as an owner-operator, or anything else about the business of trucking. Here we go. Let's head on down the audio road.
Hi, this is Lisa. Remember to talk to Kevin. Press 1 so I can pick up the phone and screen your call. You know you'd rather talk to me anyway. Or just sit back, relax, and listen to the show. And at any time you have a question, just hit 1 and I'll pick up the phone.
Welcome to Questions from the Audio Road. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. Lisa's here screening your calls. And joining me tonight is Eldon. And we're going, you know, you've heard me over the last, it's been quite a few months now. I've been talking about fuel. I've said I really need to get the lowdown on fuel and get some answers. And Eldon is our resident expert, and he does all the research on the mechanical stuff when we need that kind of stuff done. So he's gone out. He's done the research. Tonight we are going to talk all about fuel, where diesel fuel comes from, different grades of fuel and the BTU content, sulfur, lubricity, additives, alternate fuels, filtration, all kinds of stuff, fuel. So if you want to jump in and join us, pick up the phone if you're listening to us online. Pick up the phone and dial 347-884-8327. And once you're on that, press 1. If you've got a question, a comment, whatever it might be, press 1. Lisa will start screening those calls, and we're going to get right to it. So, Eldon, oh, hold on 1 second. There we go. Eldon, welcome to the program.
Well, hello, Kevin. Thanks for having me on.
Well, great to have you here. Thanks for doing all the research and the legwork, and you're going to fill us in on the lowdown on what's going on with diesel fuel, huh?
No problem. That's one of my favorite things to work with. I've been, I guess my background has been, I've probably spent more time underneath the truck than I have behind the wheel. And one of my, I worked at a dealership, and I fuel injection repair was one of my specialties. And then I left the dealership. I had built my own business, a small business doing diesel engine repair and fuel injection. So I've been working with fuel and fuel problems for a long time. But one thing I want to start off with here is just a quick Christmas update, so I get that out of the way. And I want to give out a number that, because if you call the regular number, it's busy right now. So if you want to call during this show, it's 888-523-0087. And, of course, we've been talking about Christmas for quite a bit. I just did want to make a quick, I think last night when I talked to you on the live show, my teleprompter quit right when my medication ran out, and I forgot. we were talking about, you know, having a nice, accurate tire gauge and how important that is for an owner-operator to, you know, get the most miles out of a tire. And it's available separately in our Christmas store at letstruckchristmas.com. It's available in a package deal with two great books from Mike Beckett. You buy those two, we're going to give you a free tire gauge along with it, and some I think it's five chances at a free alignment that MD Alignment has donated. So that's a real good deal. And to top it all off, I'm going to go out and buy you a tread depth gauge and throw that in on the package, and so you'll have everything you need to hopefully increase your tire life.
That is a great deal, and you know, I'm glad it's available separately because I already have the books from Mike, and they are fantastic. I mean, I highly recommend those to everybody, but I do need a really good tire gauge. I'm tired of the junk. Even when you try to buy the better ones, I mean, you spend a little more money on them, they still have the plastic insert, never really sure that they're accurate. And I've talked to Mike about this, and he said that he carries a calibrated tire gauge, and he is absolutely amazed at how many times he'll check a tire shop or, you know, a fleet's tire shop, and how far off their gauges are.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you think about it, if you're putting a gauge on there and your gauge is, you know, 10 or 20 pounds off and you don't even know it, but, you know, how's that going to affect your tire life and your fuel mileage? So at some point, you know, it's, you know, you got to have good equipment to do a good job. And so that was why I was searching high and low for that, and I was glad I found a good quality one that we could put out for our Christmas special. So,
well, I know I need to get in there and order mine, so.
Okie doke. Well, we'll be glad to, and, you know, everybody else in it, it's, I guess, just to repeat that, it's all metal, it's made in USA, and calibratable gauge, which is the best for accuracy, and if you take care of that, it'll last you a long time. Now, we got to get to fuel because, you know, tires was our number three expense in the trucking business, and our number one expense is fuel. So I think it's worth spending a little time on education there. I know we the number one thing talked about on the show is fuel mileage. So
there's a lot of misconception and myth, and I just don't think very many people understand fuel. I think for most of us, we have to have it. We use it every day. But all we really know is we pull into the pump, we stick the nozzle in there, and we get fuel and we pay for it, and we usually complain about the price. But beyond that, I don't think very many people know a whole lot about fuel. And I think there's a lot to know.
There is a lot. There's actually there's a lot more than I know. I can just paint a picture of it here, but you know, the guys that actually formulate the stuff and do the stuff, they're chemists and they wear white coats and they do all kinds of stuff, and I can't really you know, talk about it on that level, but I don't think our listeners really need that either. So I'll try and get it to a level here we can all get something out of. So anyway, as a general rule, our fuel is made from petroleum-based crude oil. There's a few specialty fuels and synthetic.
Hey, Elton?
Yeah.
Are you moving around?
Not really. Am I fading out?
You were breaking up there. Now you sound much better. Start over again.
Okay. The diesel fuel and our common fuels like gasoline and so on are made from petroleum-based crude oil. And the way they're refined, it's basically a distillation process. So what I would define as a lighter fuel being, let's say, kerosene, is a lighter specific gravity than, say, number two fuel or a heavier fuel. So on the way it's made is the stuff is heated and the molecular compounds kind of separate, or, you know, sort of like distilling water. You know, the lighter stuff goes up and then condenses into fuel. And say the very lightest at the top end would be like a solvent, and then a lighter fuel, maybe gasoline, and then diesel fuel. Maybe get down a little lower, it's the oil, crude, or base stock for motor oil, and then below that is stuff like tar that's used on for asphalt for roads, and carbon black, and compounds that go into tires. There's thousands of things that come out of the crude oil, but what we're generally concerned with is diesel fuel, because we use so much of it, and the secondary thing that we get the most out of crude oil is gasoline. So number two diesel, you know, is at a certain point in that distillation process. Due to the changes in our emission standards and the changes in the diesel fuel, the number two fuel now goes through another process after it is comes out of this distillation tower. It goes back in again through it's called hydrotreating or hydrocracking process that takes the sulfur out, and it removes some of the other compounds like paraffin, and changes the amount of some other compounds in there. So the fuel's a little bit lower BTU content when the sulfur is taken out. Also lower lubricity, and but a cleaner burning fuel. So, and this is why it needs to go through that process. Now, on the I try to put a few numbers here so we can kind of compare. Number two ULSD is and it varies a little bit, but an average of about 138,700 BTUs per U.S. gallon. One of the next common fuels, the biodiesel, comes in at about 126,000, so it's less BTUs. Number one, ULSD, 136,000, so it's about 2,000 less than number two. Then you got jet fuel. Now, that's in at about 135,000. That's really kerosene. Jet fuel is, you know, kind of about the same in the specific gravity and so on. Gasoline, regular gasoline, 125,000 BTUs. Pretty common is gasohol, 10% ethanol and 90% gasoline. That drops it down to 121,000 BTUs per gallon. And then propane comes in right at 92,000 BTUs per gallon. So right now, as we get into winter and start getting into the blended fuels, you can see we're mixing, you know, say 50% number one with 50% number two will drop a fair amount of our energy content out of a gallon of fuel.
Hey, let me jump in right there. Is that still what they do for winter blends? Are they still mixing number one and number two, or are there other processes to get a winter blend fuel?
It depends on where you're at in the country. You know, on the continent here, I guess we're talking, you know, North America, so. Generally, in the southern states of the U.S., you may have typically no blending, but the level that the fuel is refined at, it generally has some winter additives put in at the refinery level So they'll put in a pour point depressant or pour point modifier to change the point at where the waxing and the gelling occurs. As you go further north, and generally as the weather gets colder, then you will get some blending. So a northern state like, say, Minnesota will probably have some blended fuel already, and maybe as it gets colder, they'll, you know, go to a higher blend and perhaps even run straight number one or even kerosene if it gets very cold. Now,
I don't know if you were able to find out in the research or not. I kind of looked around for it and I couldn't find it. You gave the BTU numbers for ultra low sulfur. Does anybody know, or could you find what the BTU content was, say, in the 90s before we started taking sulfur out at all? Where we were, you know, well above where we are now.
Yeah, I know that off the top of my head. It was over 140,000. Typically, we could get 141,000 even in some premium fuels. And also, another term that is used for diesel fuel is the cetane value. And that also has dropped with the changes, you know, for the emission controls and so on. Our cetane value has went, it used to be a minimum of 45. Now the specs call for a minimum of 40. Typically, in ULSD, the range is about 42 to, you know, just under 45. And, but the, I guess how I was looking at that change is we had the same fuel for nearly 100 years. You know, when the diesel engine was developed, and they used all kinds of different vegetable oils and different things to get this compression ignition, and they had this product. They were, you know, the stories go that they were just pumping it into streams and rivers because, you know, you just get rid of it. It was just a waste product. And didn't have the EPA back then, I guess. But they found out they could run this engine on it, and that, you know, and these people were able to kind of tweak their refinery and came up with a product that was, you know, pretty good quality. At least the engines were all designed around that fuel up until the first change in the 90s. So we, you know, basically got used to having, you know, so much energy content, so much lubricity, and the properties of the fuel really hadn't changed for a long, long time. What kind of drove the changes was, I guess, the health risk, you know, from the pollutants emitted by not only, you know, gasoline engines, diesel engines, you know, all kinds of internal combustion engines. So trucking or the, you know, diesel fuel usage is, I mean, it's the number one market for number two diesel fuel. So that's why, you know, focusing on that, reducing the emissions from that particular sector was one of the first things. Now, we all see locomotives going down the tracks, you know, shooting up. Well, they smoke like a freight train. We wonder, why ain't they doing something there? But in the big picture, that's a smaller percentage of, you know, the amount of fuel used. But there are regulations, you know, now coming, you know, for those, and you know, they're working on cleaning that up as well. So, and one example that I would put out was, you know, I always would say that the diesel exhaust is not really harmful, and my example was, you could drive your your gas-powered car in the garage and shut the door and leave it running and sit inside, and it'd kill you. Well, you could do that with your diesel car and nothing would happen. But as I learned more about it, there is health risk from the particulate matter that you breathe in, and it accumulates over time. So it wasn't exactly it'll kill you eventually if you keep doing that. So as a kid, I used to sit on a farm tractor and go up and down the hills and love to smell that burnt diesel, but that really wasn't the best thing. So even I had to, have to admit that, we as a society, we need to kind of clean things up for the future generations. So that's why, although I don't like some of the changes in the diesel engines and the fuels, we just have to kind of bite the bullet and, change with it.
If we wanted to get some of this stuff back into the fuel, let's say we've got a pre-emission engine, we don't have to worry about DPFs or EGR valves getting sooty and all that stuff. We're totally pre-emission and we want to get some of the good stuff back in. Is there any cheap way to do that?
There's several. Yeah, there's ways to improve the fuel. There's a lot of, when you talk about, say we took the sulfur out of the diesel fuel, it's done through this process that in the refinery, it's like some kind of science experiment on, overblown on steroids. It's a real big science experiment. And
yes, so it's not like we can open up a bottle of sulfur and dump it back in and we're back to the same fuel.
No,
it's just not going to happen.
Can't do that.
Right.
This is taken out at the molecular structure of the fuel. These compounds are taken out, and it's there's sulfur used in gunpowder, but I guarantee you if you dump that in your fuel tank, you're just going to have problems. It's not the same. And I guess that there's a lot of things you just don't want to put in your fuel. And I had somebody tell me one time that they were, they wanted to take care of their, this was an old vehicle that was, nowadays would be an antique, but it's an older, 30-year-old vehicle. But he said he just wants to make sure he gets the lubricity in his fuel, so he's taken and put gear oil in there because it has sulfur in it. And, I couldn't get my tongue back up off the floor. I mean, I just didn't know what to say because the sulfur that's in there is not going to do any good, for the stuff that's taken out of the fuel. And now he's just added a whole bunch of stuff that's in the gear oil, the zinc and the other heavier compounds that are in there to prevent the gear wear are not going to burn. So as it goes, he can put it in his fuel and the thing will still run, but what's going to happen is that's going to leave deposits on the injectors, the valves, the piston rings, and in extreme case, something like that will stick the piston rings and or get under a deposit under a valve and you burn a valve. I mean, that's not the way to do it. Really the only thing you want to put in your fuel is something that's made for putting in fuel, a fuel additive that's specifically says on the bottle, this is for fuel. Another one that I hear all the time is I'm going to dump ATF in my fuel. Well,
that's probably the most common, and I go back to the early days, and I learned this from my dad. We used to change fuel filters. Instead of filling it up with diesel, we'd fill it up with ATF, and we'd dump a couple quarts in the tanks every time we got fuel. So, and I stopped that practice a long time ago, but I didn't know why I stopped because I didn't really know what it was doing or what it would do, but I still hear people ask about that one a lot now.
Well, The guys that are wearing the white coats that got the sheepskins on the wall and everything that are doing this stuff, they're the same guys that are making the fuel or making our engine oil, making our synthetic oil, and making our ATF and making, you know, all these products. And a bottle of ATF costs, what, $1.50, $2, $3, whatever, and a bottle of fuel conditioner costs 10 or 15. So if it was the same stuff, these guys are going to put their label on there and say, this is great, put it in your fuel. But the reality is what's in ATF is friction modifiers, all kinds of additives that are intended to work with inside an automatic transmission. So, you know, where you got clutch plates meshing together and gears and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And it's not the same. When you put it in the fuel, what you end up with is those kind of compounds that are made there, they won't burn. And so they'll end up leaving deposits.
So the idea has been we thought we were adding some lubricity back in and maybe cleaning some stuff out, but we might be getting a couple things that would be good for the fuel, but we're getting a whole bunch of stuff that would be bad. Kind of be like eating cheesecake every day, putting a couple strawberries on it, saying we're getting our fruit.
Yeah, yeah, we're doing the cheesecake diet here. But I guess on lubricity... you see, what is really misunderstood there is the fuel injection, diesel fuel injection business is really specialized. And this is really precision stuff that meters, you know, fuel. And, you know, we go back to mechanical pumps where you had to meter and pressurize and distribute fuel all with a little mechanical device. Those components in there are very close fitted precision parts. And where lubricity is extremely critical is engines that use rotary type pumps that are lubricated by the fuel. So your farm tractors that have been built since the 50s, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s, all use rotary pumps. Automotive engines, you know, pickups and so on, everything in the 80s had rotary pumps. So when the first change in the fuel came along and we're taking lubricity out, well, then those manufacturers are screaming, hey, we designed that pump to use that fuel that had this much lubricity, and if you drop that, it's going to wreck our product, and, you know, we're going to get blamed for your clean fuel. So we hear them screaming. I say, well, gee, I got this, you know, truck engine, and I don't want, you know, my injectors to wear out, so I'm worried about this, so I'm going to pour, and, you know, the worst thing is, say, I'm going to go pour something back in the fuel, you know, like gear oil to put it back in. That doesn't work. They took it out on the molecular level. You can put back an additive to replace that, which basically coats the metal parts and prevents the metal-metal contact. It's done with these chemists. It burns completely. It doesn't leave deposits. Doesn't have any harmful thing in it. So,
well, but let's do this then. You know, when they first went to low sulfur diesel, and I started hearing from everybody, the sky's falling, our injectors are going to fail, our fuel pumps are going to fail, there's no lubricity, we have to put additives back in our fuel. And I didn't. And I ran trucks for years, no additives, never really had any fuel system problems. So I thought, well, you know, what they were saying really didn't make any sense the way I see it, but that was just my little bit of experience. So along comes ultra-low sulfur, and everybody starts saying the same thing. Sky's falling, or we're going to wipe out injectors. We have to put additives back in our fuel. But do we really? I mean, are we doing damage to anything? And I know maybe we would add a little bit of life to a component, you know, in the long run, but are we really doing any damage to the fuel system components by running the fuel right out of the pump with no additive?
Where you risk damaging the fuel system is if you have a rotary pump or a pump that, you know, is lubricated by the fuel, only the fuel. So if you had a truck engine of the late 80s, say a Mack that had a inline pump, it wouldn't really hurt that pump. But, you know, if you had a farm tractor with a rotary pump, yes. If you had a reefer with a rotary pump, it would affect that. So it's the type of fuel system you have.
The typical Class 8 truck on the road today should be just fine.
Yeah, I'm sure if you only ran one of the things with the specs on the fuel is they're supposed to add back a agent in it when it leaves the refinery to bring the lubricity up to a minimum level, which is just fine for the fuel system in a Class 8 truck. It's where you would really want to be careful is if you have a reefer with, you know, a small rotary pump, if you have an old farm tractor, an old Dodge pickup with a rotary pump, those kind of things, automotive. And the difference is, you know, for me, I'm going to buy like 20,000 gallons of fuel this year. If I'm running it in my pickup, I'm, you know, not going to be even close to that. It's not a big deal to put an additive in your light duty vehicle all the time, and that's really
right.
What I would recommend.
Now, when you say reefer, are we talking every reefer has a rotary pump, or
no? Very, very few of the new CARB compliant ones do. They've all went to an inline or, you know, that type of system where and it's for example an injector, it just as a rule, they, whether it's a injection pump or a electronic injector, will have a plunger in it, and it fits in a bore that's a very close tolerance. You can't even measure it with a gauge. You've got to measure the fit with air. It's so close. They don't have any kind of seal on that. It's just metal to metal, typically around 40 millionths of an inch. Now, you know, it's very, very close tolerance, but it's also those components that were designed for ultra-low sulfur are the manufacturers hardened them, you know, and made them so they won't wear on lower lubricity fuels. So in the big picture, if you have a truck and you run it a million miles, or you run the same truck a million miles and use additive religiously, there may be just a small percentage of actual wear that you can prevent. But it isn't really, you know, like you say, it isn't even really worth it in those applications for that purpose. There's other ways to improve the fuel and improve the lubricity and improve the overall, you know, quality of it. And one of the best ones is the using a blend of soy biodiesel. And I have run that myself, and I've run high blends. But two, 3 to 4, 5% blend improves the fuel, the ULSD, tremendously. What has kept some of the manufacturers from endorsing a more than a 20% blend is that the cetane is a little higher on the biodiesel, and that tends to make the combustion temperature higher, and that tends to, you know, increase the formation of NOx, which is one of the things that you really have to reduce. So, you know, if you can, if that would be my number one choice. If you can find it and use it, that's a good way to improve the quality of your fuel. But, you know, as far as in a truck engine, I don't do it myself. I don't run an additive regularly for lubricity. I do in the winter, you know, to keep the fuel flowing.
Yeah, moisture problems, water. We're worried about gelling and waxing, and you know, then an additive makes sense. But it, and I've said this, so it's good to hear it confirmed from somebody who understands the inner workings and the injectors and that I just don't see the financial benefit of dumping in an expensive additive every time we get fuel, or even, I mean, I can't even see doing it weekly. Maybe monthly, but even that might seem a little extreme to me, because I'm just not sure that it's doing anything.
Well, the thing is, to prove that, it would take a long time, because let's say you've ran your truck 500,000 miles and maybe had some poor quality fuel. You know, in that 500 miles, I mean, you really don't have a choice. You're going all over the place, and you can't pull into the place and say, I want to see a laboratory analysis on your fuel before I put it in my tank. You know, it doesn't really work that way. So
right. You're
stuck with whatever you get. So somewhere, you know, going up and down the roads, and you're going to get some poor quality fuel. That tends to leave some deposits on your injectors and some of your components if it doesn't burn clean. So if you were using an additive regularly in that 500,000 miles and you got that poor quality fuel, that would keep everything clean. And it may, you know, almost pay for itself. I mean, if you could take a brand new truck and run it consistently in a brand new truck and run it without and compare it, you may be able to detect a difference. It may not be enough to pay for the additive, but it would pay some of it back. But for the most part, it's not cost effective. It may be for a fleet that runs lower miles, say a delivery fleet, or especially if you run lighter vehicles like delivery vans, and you have your own supply of fuel, those two things where it might make sense. But
hey,
the average...
I'm looking at the clock, and I'm looking at a couple calls. Why don't we bring in a couple calls here and see what questions we've got?
Okay, that sounds good.
All right, let's go to Minnesota. Matt, welcome to the program.
Actually, Kevin, can you take one other one first? I got to back into a doc right this minute.
Okay, sure. Hey, you're a professional. I think you can back up and talk at the same time. But we'll go to Wisconsin anyway. Harold, welcome to the program.
Hello, how you doing this lovely day? Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
What's on your mind tonight?
Hey, I got a good question. I got the DAFCO filter. Then I got this here truck at about 217,000 miles. And ever since day one, with the DAFCO filter, the whole thing will turn black, but it don't seem to plug up very fast.
Well, there's several things that'll do that, and if you have two things that are real common, or you know, I guess the most common is algae. But if you have that, it'll either plug the filter, or how many filters do you have in the system?
Just the DAVCO.
Just the DAVCO? Okay.
Yep.
So you should be running a two or perhaps a, you know, I always shudder when I see these systems with only one filter, but it should be a 2 micron or close to that, and so that will plug.
Real quick, how about 7 micron? Is that close?
Well, not when you got these plungers in your injectors is where. You know, you have to have the fuel clean enough to go through there without any abrasive, anything down to that small. So to protect that, you need a 2-micron final filter. Now, some manufacturers have had, you know, 5s and 7s and so on, but to me, anything in the 5 to 10 micron range is really a secondary filter. A primary filter. And your final filter in any system for protection should be right around 2 micron. So, but unless you have the wrong filter in the DAVCO, that wouldn't be your problem, because that would tend to grow and, you know, accumulate and then plug your filters real often. Now, the other thing that what year of truck is it?
It's 08.
08.
Yep.
What the trend since the early 90s, you know, I mean, even in the 80s when Detroit came out with their electronic engine, is then the fuel is circulated through the heads on these engines to cool the injectors. And so that tends to bring a lot of heat back to the tank. And so what happens is, as the fuel gets hot, you know, sometimes it's worse with the lower quality fuel, but you've heard Kevin talk about the asphaltenes, and you'll get this black stuff, and it'll catch, you know, accumulate on the components in the fuel system. So that's enough to turn the filter black where it won't really plug it, you know, just a small amount.
But won't fuel have to get to that point for either the algae or the asphaltene to collect? Like I can change the filter, start it up, then run it for a day, if even that, and the whole filter will be black, even where the fuel ain't.
Well, in your case, you know, the filter that should be in that single filter system would be a very fine filter. You know, if it's 2 micron,
right,
it doesn't take a very big particle floating through there to show up on that filter. And with the DAVCO, you got that clear dome, and you can see the fuel, you can see the filter. So, you know, that would be, I mean, if you're not having any other problem, I would just, you know, eliminating things down. That's probably what it is. And what happens is the fuel gets so warm from that return fuel, you know, gets warm. And if you let your fuel level go down, you know, there's less fuel to absorb that heat. So especially in the summertime, you'll start getting those kind of deposits.
All right. Because this is a team truck, and we, in a year and a half, or not even a year and a half yet, we've already got over 300,000 miles on it that we put on ourselves.
Well, how often do you change the filter?
We only change it when it gets full, and that there can be 3, 4, 5 months.
Okay. Well, you know, in my mind, with that kind of miles, you don't have a problem. As long
right.
as you have the proper filter in there, I would be very careful to make sure you have, you know, I don't know what the manufacturer calls for, but either use that or get one that specifically says 2 micron on it. Because, see, the thing is, if you plug the filter every 2 months, but it was a 2 micron, it'd be worth changing it more often to catch the finer particles in the fuel rather than dealing with the wear that would be caused from them going through.
You know, Elton, the reason I asked about the 7-micron filter is because when Detroit puts the DAVCO on as the only filter, they use a 7-micron on it.
Yeah, I would, you know, that's their design and their specs. They're older engines. I have one of the older engines, and it has a 10 or so. think it's a 10 or 15 micron primary, and then the secondary is a 5. Well, I decided that I didn't think that was fine enough, so you know, I got an aftermarket, a Raycor unit that was made for that application that goes down to 2. And
you know, here's another question, and you know, when we talk about oil filtration, and we know the full flow filters are, you know, in the 20 to 30 micron range, and we know they're letting a lot of junk through, but they have to. That oil has to get through. It's why it's a full flow filter. So when we filter down further to the 2 micron range using, you know, something like the EcoPure, we do it as a bypass. We're not interrupting the flow of that oil. In a fuel system, when we try to filter down to 2 micron, are we restricting the fuel flow too much?
Well, a good system is designed with this filter is sized so it will flow, you know, the proper flow. So, in other words, if you increase the amount of media, you can flow more through it, even if it's finer. And
so that makes sense.
Good system. So, I'll tell you about mine because, you know, I did it for certain reasons. I do that, but I have 3 stages right now. I have DAVCO as my primary. And right now I'm running a 50 micron in there. Now, it's going on a year and a half, maybe even 2 years old. I rarely have to change that. But that takes all the big stuff and the water out of the fuel. Then the second one in my system is a 10 micron, and it's a huge spin-on that it was a Cummins, one of their large engines, you know, like one of their big generator engines, use this huge spin-on. That's my primary filter, so I have a lot of capacity, so whatever gets through the 50 gets caught in the 10, you know, further refined down in the 10, and then my secondary is 2 micron. I end up, I normally change it about twice a year, running, you know, just under 100,000 miles, but I change it. I have a fuel pressure gauge on there, and when the pressure starts to drop, I know the filter's starting to get restricted, and that's why I change it. So, but I wanted to go back to something that you, when we're talking about additives, and you were saying you put that in there, you know, to get the water out. That's a real common thought, but that's really the wrong way to do that. In other words, you put that in there, you try and emulsify the water droplets or break them up and get them to go through. Well, see, I don't want that going through my my little plunger that has, you know, very little clearance, because water is a great big molecule, and that does a lot of damage there. It's much easier to take out the water on the suction side. So that's why on my system I chose the DAVCO, which is very good at, you know, taking the water out of the fuel. Comes through on the suction. The heavy water drops down in the bottom of the unit. The smaller particles get stripped out by the filter. And so, you know, 99% of any water in there comes out just flowing through the DAVCO. Then, you know, I have a second, you know, when it comes to the 10 micron filter, well, anything that can't easily get through there drops to the bottom of that filter. And then by the time it gets to the 2 micron, there's really nothing in there. If you put an additive in, try and make the water go through, it's going to end up where you don't want it. So a good system has some kind of water separator on the suction side. And if you have a truck with only one filter, say a spin-on filter, you can add a DAVCO ahead of that, or you can add a spin-on water separator. There's all kinds of options, but my preference is always to have at least 2 filters in the system. Don't make one do all the work, but have another one.
Got it. Let's see if Matt got back into the dock yet. Matt?
Yes, safe and sound.
All right. Good deal.
So, Actually, it's a good thing because I can comment on that a little bit. In Eldon's experiment, you know, he comes with CAT engines too. And if I'm not mistaken, CAT is about the only one that gets down to 2 micron on their fuel filters.
And, yeah, that could be. I only really look at what I have on myself, you know, and then I change it how I want it. And I haven't been able to keep up with new stuff. I have, when I see some of this stuff, I say, you know, that's not a fuel system that will, for the long haul, that will, you know, do a good job. So,
And, you know, older engines, it wasn't as important. I mean, we got to go all the way back to mechanical engines. It wasn't as important because the fuel pressure has a lot to do with it. I mean, if we go way back into the 70s when they started going to high-pressure hydraulics, they started burning up hydraulic pumps and all that because they didn't have fine enough filters on it when it got to higher pressure. And I heard the rumor it was the 7 to 15 micron, if you're up into that 20,000 PSI range, because that size micron has the sharpest edges. But once you get that under high pressure, it does severe damage. That was a story I heard many years ago. But
well, when you talk about microns, about 40 microns is the limit of, you know, that you can see with the naked eye. Yeah, and a human hair is maybe 50, you know, and 50 to 60. So, you know, you start getting that. Well, this is in millions. You know, microns are millions of an inch. So you're dealing with very small clearances, and when something abrasive goes in there, you know, it just destroys that clearance. And the other thing it does, if it wears out between, say, a plunger and a barrel, then that lets the fuel that you're supposed to be pushing into the cylinder, that lets that escape. And then you don't get the right amount in, so you get a sloppy injection, and, you know, then it doesn't burn right. You get less mileage, less power.
Hey,
so,
If we're concerned, and those are really tight tolerances, that all makes sense. What about the practice of filling up our fuel filter before we put it on?
That's not recommended by, you know, a lot of manufacturers, and that's a really good point. If you're going to do that, and, you know, I do that, but what I do is I pour the fuel. Yeah, and I might do it with my thumb, you know, punch my thumb into the center of the filter so nothing can get in there, and then pour the fuel in the outside so it's forced to go through the media and it's, you know, still filtered. But, and this is another reason why I like two filters in the system. See, then, because mine, I don't change them until they need to be, so I always got some protection when I'm changing a filter. And people tend to, especially in the winter, kind of over-service the thing. You know, every time you take that filter off, you're going to get, you know, chance of getting something in there, you know, whether it's a piece of dust or, you know, something on the filter base or whatever. So the less times you do it, the better. You know, you don't risk the contamination.
Real quick, because we're going to run out of time here. This is going fast.
Yeah.
I had a question about with blended fuel, and with I actually didn't hear all of what you said because I pushed one, and Lisa's so good she picked up right away. But have you heard of blending kerosene in with diesel for a winter additive?
Yes, and it is not, you know, on the big picture, it's not. It's a little bit lighter than number one, but as a blending agent, you know, blending it into fuel is generally the problem with kerosene is the cost is higher than. But, for example, if you go far into Alaska, the standard fuel there is jet fuel, which is, you know, along the lines of kerosene. It's actually winterized jet fuel, so they can operate at, you know, 40 below, 40 and 50 below, and they don't do anything to their fuel because it's already light enough. But you certainly give up some of the you know, the BTUs with that.
You know, as far as anything you buy in at the truck stop and a jug and dump in, just never seems to work for me.
Well, here's a point I wanted to get to, and I see that in my notes I'm getting a couple of the lines, and the rest of it I can't read because the ink's dry, but we didn't get to a lot of stuff. But one thing I need to get out about putting in winter additives, they are concentrated. When you buy it in the truck stop, it's concentrated, although actually they put a small amount of concentrated stuff into a half a gallon of, you know, basically other ingredients. Because if I told you to take this eyedropper and go put it in your tank, you'd say, oh, that ain't going to work. I got to have a half a gallon. So
yeah, and you wouldn't want to pay $10 for the eyedropper worth of stuff either.
You wouldn't want to pay it, but if you know, get down to the actual concentrated ingredient. But because it's concentrated, it has to be blended with the fuel above the cloud point. You can't take the additive and leave it out in 0 degrees and then have your truck sitting there with 0 degree fuel and then say, oh, gee, I better put this in because it's cold. You need to have that additive, and like if you carry it with you, you need to keep it at least above the cloud point of the fuel, or at least above freezing. And then the best time to put it in is when you're fueling, because, you know, generally the fuel's underground and it's, you know, way above the cloud point, which is typically 10 to 20 degrees. You know, the ULSD I've tested, I can get it to start to cloud around 5 degrees maybe consistently. So I like to be treating it if I know the temperature is going to be 10 degrees above that, so at, you know, 15, so say below 20. But
hey, Elton, I'm going to squeeze in one more quick question here and see if maybe we can answer it before we've got to wrap it up. Bob in Iowa, real quick, what's your question?
Yeah, well, I bought a truck, it's a 98 Volvo with an N14 Cummins, and was running it without any changes to it. It was getting like 7.2, put the turbo 3000 on it, got it up to about 7.4, and then a guy said, well, he used a magnet on his system. And anyway, I was pulling a lighter load, got it up to 8.2, pulled a couple more heavier loads, and it went back down to 7.3. So my question is, do you think there's any merit to putting the magnet on your fuel system?
Well, that's one that I haven't tried. I've read up on it and, you know, read the testimonials and how it's supposed to work and all that. I don't know. I think you know that may work in some situations, but you're getting pretty good mileage there. I don't know. What I'd say is, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Well, and I agree with that. You know, I'm always trying to push for a little more. But what this points out is, you had a wild swing in fuel mileage there. And this is the real problem we run up against when we're trying to either prove or disprove something works. There are way, way too many variables. Unless you really understand how to test something and you control as many variables as you can possibly control and do it over a long period of time, and this is one of the reasons why, you know, people will say, well, why haven't you tested this yet? Because sometimes it takes us months just to test one device. If I'm testing something and I get a good 30-day running average prior to testing, then I go to test it and we have a truck that breaks down, or sometimes even if I have to change fuel filters in the middle of the test, something that small could literally invalidate the results. It's a variable that could have affected the outcome. And when we're talking about trying to measure a couple tenths of a mile per gallon improvement, it's really difficult to do. So, unfortunately, we're all out of time. Elton, I want to thank you for doing all the homework. I learned a bunch of stuff tonight, and I'm sure I'm going to have another assignment for you soon.
Well, we're going to have to do this again. I didn't get to the military and some of the really good stuff, so we got to do this again.
Got it. All right. Thanks for everything. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. See you on the live show in 30 minutes. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Good night, everyone.